I'm here with Jim Krestovic, who has written several books over the years. I believe your first was Navajos Wear Nikes?
Yes.
And, you know, we could think of Navajos Wear Nikes, which was autobiographical, as a recent history of Ganado and the region. Your latest book, Medicine Women, the story of the first Native American nursing school, we could look at as a more comprehensive history going back a century or more of Ganado and the region.
Yes, it's action of the book begins roughly after the Long Walk, 1868. People were coming back and trying to make a life again, and the action centers around Fort Defiance, where the first Presbyterian doctors and missionaries tried to, I don't know, you could say Americanize people or help them organize around the social institutions that they were using. And the action proceeds from 1868 and roughly ends around 1970 in the Ganado Summit, kind of Defiance Plateau Summit, Fort Defiance region.
It's really a history of Ganado in particular.
Yeah, I thought it was really important to not just talk about how this nursing school built up and not just talk about how the hospital built up, but how the idea that this was even acceptable to take place built up. So the goodwill that the Presbyterians were able to accrue in that region from the people to be accepted to even approach that area, that local Nat'ani chieftains were willing to give their thumbprint and allow them to come. I thought it was important to talk about people like J.L. Hubble, to talk about people like William Riley Johnston, who played a role in establishing trust with local people. We'd call them today social justice pursuers or advocates for the people, Johnston in particular, whose son, Philip Johnston, was the person who was a engineer for the Marine Corps prior to World War II, and during World War II recommended the idea of establishing the Kotoker Corps. So there's a connection there as well.
If we look at all of the different connections, as you do talk about in the book, Ganado traces its lineage to, well, its namesake, Ganado Mucho, to Juan Lorenzo Hubble, Hubble Trading Post founder, and then, of course, the Ganado Mission itself.
The Ganado Mission wouldn't have really established there the way it did if not for the advocacy of J.L. Hubble, who was able to clearly explain the long-term benefits of having a medical establishment, a hospital, and a school in that region. And that hospital was established well enough to spare the Ganado area some of the many casualties of the 1918 flu epidemic. They were able to offer up an option away from government schooling, which was happening at that time. Some people, when they've asked me, you know, why did you write a book about boarding schools? Because there was a boarding school there at the nurses' school. But they're incorrectly conflating what was going on at Ganado Mission. Ganado Mission, for a lot of people I interviewed, and I did an oral history project for about 10 years to find the information I needed. And I interviewed about 20 people from the Ganado area, and I read something like over 100 oral histories that are reposited at the Hubble Archives by the National Park Service and the Arizona Historical Society. And what a lot of those people said was, some of them had actually gone to the government school in Fort Defiance, and they didn't find the conditions very palatable, shall we say. Oftentimes, they dressed in coveralls. They weren't even allowed to have their own toothbrush or hairbrush. A very harsh treatment, walk in lines like little soldiers. Whereas at Ganado Mission, the students were under the care of what was called like a house mother or a dorm matron, who they talk about, the people who had gone to school there, talk about in pretty glowing terms a way people would usually talk about a really nice grandmother or aunt that they had growing up. They were allowed to have individual property in their dorms. They were encouraged to dress nice and look nice to become very ideal And, you know, optimistic Americans about this experiment of a country that was going on at that time. And so they were also there voluntarily. Their parents paid a tuition. Often this was not in cash. One of the parts of the research was I actually looked at all the ledgers for the tuition payments and sat down with them. Most of it was in mutton and cordwood. Some of it was cash, but it was usually less than 20%. Of a yearly tuition bill. But even when they started tuition, a lot of people at that school worried that, oh, once you start charging people to come here, it's going to fail. No one's going to show up. It didn't change anything. Once they started charging people, people still showed up because they knew it was a good option and it would educate their kids to compete in America.
And why did the Presbyterian Church establish a mission in Ganado?
It really comes down to water. Water and goodwill, I would say. Ganado had a reliable water source, and this really all started because of this. He was, a maverick missionary, William Riley Johnston, who came out originally to have a mission near Tolchaco, which is kind of near the Hopi lands, kind of near Cameron. And he was the one who led the elders from Flagstaff up into the Navajo land or Navajo country. And they originally thought, well, we'll just establish again at Fort Defiance. They tried doing that approximately 30 years before, and it failed. It didn't work, and that missionary was kind of driven from his post. He wasn't appreciated there, and for good reasons. I mean, that I go into in the book. But the Ganado region they selected primarily because of the hospitality of J.L. Hubble to the idea. Hubble was a great intermediary between Ganado Mucho, as you say, the chieftain and his sons, who kind of headed the area, and people followed their lead because they made wise decisions overall that benefited their families. And so they could diplomatically work with them. There also, though, was a good source of water. And Hubble was establishing irrigation canals, much like the Acequia system in Pajarito, where he was from, and you see a lot still in northern New Mexico. And so it was a way to make a life, to have more children and take back their country, essentially, through population. That was one of the orders they were given when they survived the Long Walk, was have lots of kids and never let us vanish. And so this seemed like an arrangement where it would secure their progeny, you know, into the future. Yeah.
Well, both Ganado Mucho and Hubble were very instrumental in getting that mission established.
Yes, the goodwill they carried, if they said, do this, it will help you, people were like, okay, yeah, we'll do that. Now, they were, Ganado Mission was also fortunate in that It attracted people to a rural area. It's kind of like if you didn't want to be there, that place just spat you out. You had to really want to be there. So only very determined kind of people would go out that far into what was then a really unpopulated area. No dirt roads or anything like that. It was all wagons. And this was, you know, 1901, 1902. But they were also fortunate in that they the Chinese revolted. So over in China, they had a revolution. A lot of the Presbyterian missions were kicked out of China. And there's a particular missionary who had been there for almost 20 years on the island of Hainan, who was a Canadian doctor who was educated in New York, named Dr. Clarence Salisbury. And he came to Ganado as a fluke in 1927, as a temporary assignment because he wanted to get back to China. So they just put him there, give him something to do for a while until he could go back overseas. And he ended up staying there for over 25 years and totally changing how Ganado worked and functioned. But he brought this really, really, and even students and faculty who have a bit of a beef with him on a personal level would admit that he was an incredibly dynamic, energetic individual. And as someone who's read probably over 300 of his letters, I would say that is true. He communicated that way. He was very boisterous. It's sort of, he is this, I don't know how I would describe him, maybe a this goodwill doctor, but he had this this personality and humor that would probably do very well on most late night talk shows in America. He was very personable and he liked being very hospitable. He had a lot in common with J.L. Hubble in that regard. He wanted people to like him. He wanted to please people. And but he was also a bit of a dictator, so he knew how to establish rules and keep them. But he was often considered a benevolent dictator, and his rules usually served the public good. And whenever the church, Presbyterian Church, or the U.S. government broke goodwill of the public good, he was the first to write editorials and critique them. He was very much against nuclear armament after World War II. He even allowed doctors to publicly give lectures there at the mission, just ripping America apart for allowing this sort of thing to emerge. Yeah.
And while Gonato Mission obviously had an evangelical objective.
Oh, yes.
How they wanted to achieve that and how they recognized they would need to achieve that was basically through what we might call good works, and that came back to the question of medicine and healthcare.
Yes, Gonato Mission originally started with people who wanted to go out and keep these native people from singing to the devil and falling into the smut of hell, for sure. If you look at all the rhetoric coming out between about 1902 and 1918, that was very much the idea. But it's also clear in the correspondence that Salisbury wrote that he was very much against this idea. And he, in confidential letters, which I've read, and in personal letters to, because they would raise money by sending letters to people who would sponsor them. In these letters, he'd say, you know, we're really not trying to do any more of that hell and brimstone talk here. What he was trying to do, you know, he had other people trying to save their souls, but he wanted to save their lives more than anything. And what he thought the most effective way, most effective missionary device there in Gonato would be the hospital. People would see the benefits of American Western medicine, that it could cure diseases that their medicine men didn't know how to cure because they'd never seen trachoma, they'd never seen tuberculosis that was brought by Europeans. And so, but he did give a lot of credence to that, and that's another reason why it did succeed, is that, yes, there were signs on that campus. And this is the thing that the Presbyterian Church, when I've spoken to them, I won't say they're denying anything. There's a misunderstanding. That mission had signs on that campus that said, tradition is the enemy of progress. There are signs on that campus that said, you know, kill the Indian to save the man. These are signs. I mean, I've seen the photographs. They exist. And if anyone says they're not there, that's just not true. But everyone I talk to who's an alumni of that place remembers the signs. On the other hand, they also allowed local hatashe, the medicine men, medicine singers, to come on campus, cut spruce boughs from the trees to use as the collars in the Yebiche dance. They also had several hogans built on the campus to allow people to have a more comfortable traditional setting in which to stay while their relatives were in the hospital. So there was a get-along attitude that was there overall. Certain staff members at the place, I'm sure that they had differing opinions on the way to govern what they called evangelicalism. A lot of the evangelism, though, in the research I found, it was pretty quiet on campus. They would have people go into the hospital and talk to people about Jesus, but they also sent out what they called gospel teams more to people's homes to, like, have a visit with them and talk with them and sing Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, and all of that. But a lot of the people in that region, the way they saw it, they weren't being asked to discard their beliefs so much as add something to them, you know. So you can have your traditional beliefs, you can also have this Presbyterianism or whatever you want, because ultimately the Presbyterian Church had no control over their fate whatsoever. I mean, they were there offering things to them, but it wasn't in the way that the government would have control over, say, annuity goods or what would be called, you know, commodity food. The Presbyterian Church just simply didn't have the resources to control their lives. So if they wanted to step away from Presbyterianism, they could very easily. If they wanted to come to hospital and not really hear about Presbyterianism and just get treated, that happened too. So because it was so far removed from any government power center, I think it was understood by the doctors who were there, judging from correspondence, from oral histories, from former students, that the evangelism wasn't as aggressive, because if it had been, they would have revolted. They wouldn't have shown up. Yeah.
Many of the people in the region, because of what they'd experienced from the U.S. government, because of what they'd heard about treatment of their children in BIA schools, where the children, in many cases, had been pulled away from the families, were probably a little reticent to come in to get care or education, for that matter.
Oh, very much so. People, because of the traditional beliefs about how spirits work after you pass away and how death affects a place, they were very reluctant to come in. That is absolutely true. The only reason they did is because, big thing that shifted it was that Salisbury was able to understand, through translators speaking with local medicine men and also speaking with some of them who knew English, that they really were the gatekeepers. They were the ones who held the trust of the local families in that region. And so there were times when the medicine men would come in because their ceremonies weren't curing them of pneumonia or of influenza or trachoma. And so when he had them in the hospital, he actually got five of them together and took a photograph of them and had it plastered over the community saying, hey, you know, all medicine men are coming to the hospital, you should too. And that led to a real surge in patients understanding, okay, I can go in, get the white man's medicine for the white man's diseases and treat it this way, but I'll also go out and have my ceremony done when I want it and need it. So there was both. Both were going. One didn't replace the other, at least during the time that the nurses' school was happening there. But it really almost did fall apart. From my research that I saw, if the community didn't want that place there, it really would have ended. And that's actually how I begin the book. The book begins with the story that took place, and Salisbury writes about this in his own autobiography that was published by University of Arizona Press several decades ago, of the first surgery patient he had. It was a young girl who had broken her leg, not really sure how. Maybe she'd fallen off a fence, maybe she fell off a horse. There was a fall involved. And and her leg was growing crooked. It was healing crooked, so he was going to reset her bone. And he explained how the procedure would work, told the people in the family who was waiting outside what was going to happen. And he sets it up, puts her under anesthesia. He starts resetting the bone, and she has an embolism, which is essentially a blood clot kind of careening through her arteries and veins, and it stops the heart. And this happens in surgeries today, even. And she passed away. And everyone runs out of the hospital. They don't run. They're kind of sick. But they got out of the windows. They walked away. And the local talk was that the family went over, and they were going to, you know, rally and have their vengeance on this awful person who killed their daughter. But it was the local medicine singer, who they call Mr. Redpoint, and so Redpoint, he was the one who calmed the crowd down. He'd experienced this kind of loss before. He knew that all medicine ceremonies don't work, therefore all medical treatments don't work, and cool heads prevailed. And even though his patient count dropped precipitously, very few people came to the hospital for almost a year, eventually they started coming back. And it was understood that this was something that was not going to happen again. And it didn't. He didn't really lose many surgery patients. He was actually acknowledged as being a very good surgeon by many international colleague kind of organizations. He had doctors from Harvard coming out. He was doing clinics with them there at the campus. Harlow Brooks, William Mayo, founder of the Mayo Clinic, and saved several people's lives using new surgery methods, using things like an iron lung, which are detailed in the book, and those stories are there. So the proof was in the pudding that this person could be trusted. He wasn't going to disrespect people, and didn't make too many enemies.
Yeah. No, it was the school that came first before the first hospital.
Correct. The school started out actually on Hubble's property in a small adobe house when the missionary who had come there, his name was Reverend Charles Bierkemper. He was from Katanning, Pennsylvania. He married an older woman who had been a school teacher in Missouri, and she came out and started this little school. And I interviewed a few people who had grandmothers and great-grandmothers who went there, and they remembered singing Frère Jacques and eating cookies and just kind of interacting with European culture in a very simple way. But eventually, yes, it became a school where the boys and girls who arrived there, they were living in dorms. A large adobe building at first that they built, they helped build with these adobe bricks they would make at the site under the supervision of Hubble's laborers who would come over. Some of them were Spanish men from the Rio Grande Valley. Some of them were local Navajo men who had worked with them. Many of these men who were the foremen were also medicine men. So they knew what they were doing. They knew they were building churches and making schools. There was no illusions here. They thought it would be a way to at least approach American occupation on their own terms. And they could have it under their local control. They wouldn't have to send their kids more than a horse ride away, a day's horse ride away. So the school started up, and it was, they did have a schoolhouse, a small schoolhouse, which they moved around the campus three different times. I went to Sunday school in that schoolhouse, which is still there. And the doctor really was just a man from Greensburg, Pennsylvania, who came out there in, I believe it was 1906. I could be wrong, but it's been so long since I thought about this stuff. mid 1900 there, and he was there for about 9 years, and he just had a little room in the back of the church building. He would have gotten there. I believe it would have been 1910. Yeah, and most of the time he wasn't on campus at all. He would be traveling out, walking around, taking medicines to people because they had no reason to come there. They were out at their sheep camp, taking care of their livestock. So he'd come out, find people with trachoma, give them sulfa drugs. If they had influenza problems, he'd give them whatever remedy he could. Recommend resting. Tell people about germ infection. How you shouldn't use the same towel. It's better to use the dirt off the ground than use the same towel as someone with trachoma, and explain to them how to sterilize things. It was largely an off-campus thing. But the school eventually brought in people from as far away as the American South. The Presbyterian Church had a lot of experience in the South after the war. I've never read a formal history of their efforts in the South, but as I understand, they were pretty effective there, helping people after quote-unquote Reconstruction, which didn't really work at all. And so they would bring in students sometimes in American South, sometimes teachers would come there, and they were also able to bring in other students from Native American reservations who just wanted a quiet place to learn, speak English, and maybe find a place in the American economy.
Salisbury, in particular, espoused a sense of diversity in his outreach. And as the hospital was developed, as the first nursing school was developed, encouraged recruitment from a variety of tribes and sometimes nationalities over the years.
He liked to joke about how a Ganado Mission and the School of Nursing was an international community hiding in the middle of Navajo country. They had doctors who taught there who were Chinese, who had come over from China. Co-conspirator or his wingman was a doctor named William Duncan Spinning, who was from Chile, and he was born to missionary parents in Chile. So he spoke fluent Spanish and had come up there thinking, oh, I'll be here for a little while, then I'll go back down to Latin America. I fell in love with the place, raised his family there, and his children still reside in Flagstaff today. But he did get to finish his career in Embudo, so he enjoyed that, getting to speak Spanish again. But yes, a lot of the doctors and faculty, some were from Switzerland. Other people were Negroes from the South who'd come up there. And they brought in students from as far away as Alaska. They brought in a lot of Cuban-American women, Spanish women. A lot of the instructors and students were from around the Embudo, northern New Mexico area, Ojo Zarco, which is near Truchas, New Mexico. They even pulled students who were Japanese out of the internment camps during World War II near Tucson. One of those students actually received the highest score on the nursing board's examinations in the state of Arizona. So
it was the only perfect score.
Only perfect score, yeah. Yeah.
Mary Kumbara.
Yeah. And so it was a very much an international community, and they had their own little traditions and rituals that they would teach the students, and the students really enjoyed it. It was like having a foreigner coming and telling you about where they're from, and it kind of puts your imagination out of the place where you were at, which was really quite, we almost can't even imagine what the world was like back then, where you didn't even hear electrical lines buzzing most of the time. You nothing, you know, just the wind and the pinyons. But, and that can be, you know, a bit strange to some people, so it can feel a little isolating sometimes. And so the students in the community did like to come in for what they called Camp Christmas, where they do a Christmas celebration every year. It was just like any other ceremony where large groups of people would get off of their sheep camps, come together, kind of party down or see each other, visit, have mutton, share a fire, sleep near each other for a couple days, and then they go back home to their relatively isolated areas and enjoy that ice, because that isolation has its own blessings, that's for sure. Yeah, but yes, it was a rather diverse community, and Salisbury did grant quite a lot of authority to women on the campus as well. He recognized, and you can see it in his staff evaluations that I've read, that a lot of the women who were able to persist there had very strong personalities. His wife had a very strong personality, and what people realized after Salisbury left was that Salisbury only did half the work there. His wife did the other half of the work. And without so really it was two people doing one job. And when one person tried to do that job, it didn't work so well. It worked, but it didn't work the same way.
While Salisbury had his own issues with prejudice and stereotyping, he did have as an objective to overcome some of the entrenched racism across the country and the world that basically debunked the idea that any Native American or minority person was capable of aspiring to a technical function or a professional career.
Yeah, he heard from people in the church and from other doctors. He said they said red women are never going to wear white. They're never going to be smart enough to be able to do this job. It's not going to happen. And he said, well, these aren't red women. They're human beings. And that goes back to the Protestant ethic, which says that, you know, there isn't one passage in the Bible that says slavery is wrong, right? But there is an understanding that we are all children of God. So if that's logically true, then therefore you can't enslave a child of God, right? Likewise, a child of God is a child of God regardless of their skin color or their ethnicity. They're still children of God. And so you have to treat everyone as though you're talking to someone who's descended from this Heavenly Father, right? And that's the Protestant logic at that time, the Presbyterian logic. And so Salisbury followed that. And that is what led him to understand that, yes, these women, he saw their intelligence on a daily basis. So it was partly his experience just seeing that, yes, these are very intelligent people. And he would write about this constantly to his fundraisers, to the community. He had a newspaper called the Ganado News Bulletin that he would publish quarterly. And that was a very similar line you heard over and over. If you want us to tell you what these Navajo kids are like, they're like any other American kid. And so their goal was assimilation on their part. That is true. Their logic was because there were two ways of thinking about this. There was the John Collier way of thinking about it, which is, and it's still here today, and it's a tension, which is what is, and this is what my first book was about, partly, like, what is a Native American? What is an Indian, quote unquote? What is that anyway?
You know? John Collier was a government official who started the Fort Defiance Hospital.
Correct, yeah. He was the superintendent of Indian Affairs, which was technically his position. And his perspective was the Native American lives within the traditions that they have. As long as they hold to those traditions and prayers and songs, they will stay that way. And Salisbury's perspective was, yes, they will stay that way, and they're all going to die off because they couldn't economically compete with this massive country that was surrounding them and just kind of, you know, picking at their borders constantly. And so Salisbury's perspective was, well, if they want to preserve their traditions, that's up to them. That's not my job. My job is to show them what America is and to get them ready to survive in it. He went so far, though, as to believe that what should happen is, first of all, Native Americans should be able to vote, which they couldn't at the time. Okay, so them living on a reservation, that was just delaying the inevitable. Eventually, they were gonna just be overridden, and they wouldn't have any sovereignty because they couldn't own property and improve it. This is his perspective, right? I'm not saying it's my perspective, but it's his perspective. And so, what would be best for them is to be able to economically compete inside America to beat the white man at his own game, which was that's a quote from Salisbury there, and then while beating the white man at his own game, they would be able to also preserve their traditions in a way that they felt was most comfortable to them. And so he would deride Collier and people of that perspective as making Navajo people into a walking museum exhibition, like a mannequin that walks around, whereas he didn't want a wooden, as he put it, a wooden cigar Indian in his community. He want like a vibrant human being who's diverse in their beliefs, and if they can speak English and Navajo, that's better. That was his perspective. Now, how correct that is, that's what we get to talk about, right? But at least I thought the book could correctly show what was going on at that time and what people were struggling with. And what I truly try to communicate in the book, and I think the readers who have responded to it thus far have told me is they didn't really know how it was all going to end. Like, it read more like a novel than a history. And that's what I wanted to communicate, is that no one at that time knew how this was all going to shake out. I mean, they didn't know if the Navajo people were going to be around another 50 or 60 years. Most Americans didn't think they were. They called them the vanishing race. I mean, that's what people of Salisbury's school, his generation, were taught, that the Native Americans are a vanishing race, and they're going to be gone, so we need to go out and catalog their language and get everything down because they're out of here. They're toast. And a lot of people who worked for Salisbury didn't believe that. But the ones who did saw it as their sacred duty to save these people's lives, because they understood that their nation state and the larger culture was there to prey upon them. I mean, they understood that. Yeah.
Salisbury was one of the driving forces behind the history of the mission, and during his 20-some years there, he not only developed new schools, new buildings, a hospital, established the nursing school, basically as a result of his efforts and all of the people who worked there, that mission became a small city, a complex.
Yeah, people were pretty astounded when they went there how modern it was. There's one story from the book of a woman who, her friends threw her a steak and ice cream party before she left because they figure she's never going to have steak and ice cream again because she's going out in the Wild West to live with the wild Indians. And so she goes out to Ganado Mission, and the first thing they served when she was there was steak and ice cream at the cafeteria. So she's like, oh my gosh, this place is more advanced than I thought. That was the point of the place, I think, was to demonstrate or exhibit all of the amenities that the American civilization had to offer. I mean, there's a coal-burning power plant right there in the middle of campus. Salisbury brings in this massive smokestack for this fire belching strange technology that's going to be placed in the middle of the campus. And I mean, these engines, the diesel engines that would back up these boilers where it generated this electrical power, they were so powerful you could put your chest on the ground at Snake Flat, which is like 5-6 miles away from Gannat, and you could feel the thumping in your chest. I mean, so these were loud engines. He brings in these smokestacks, and the first thing he does, while they're still on the truck, he has the kids go up and have a tea party right in the middle of them to get them used to it. Like, this is a new technology. Isn't this so great? Okay, now don't mess around with these anymore. But yeah, be friendly with them. You know, this is good. This is a new, amazing way of life that you're going to live. Welcome to it. This was his perspective. And so now we today, you know, no understanding climate change and understanding, you know, the problems with coal and how many people they kill every year. They didn't know this back then, of course, you know, but it does pose an interesting question of what we embrace now that we don't know is coming 80 years from now. 5G, just saying.
You know, hundreds and hundreds of people over, you know, 30, 40 years were involved in everything that happened at the mission. And you highlighted a number of stories in there, not only of faculty, students, doctors, nurses, but of visitors.
Many visitors to the campus. They had these summer clinics where Harlow Brooks, who was a renowned surgeon, medical researcher at that time, he just coincidentally had also grown up around a lot of Native Americans in his home state and had actually ridden across the American prairie 4 times as a young man, knew many Native Americans growing up. They taught him how to ride, you know, move around on horseback. And so he had a great affinity for Native culture. And he liked what was going on at Gannat Mission. He thought that the local culture, which was really the dominant force at that time. So the American Protestantism being there was not mainstream. If you look at the population of the valley, most people are very traditional, hardly speaking English at that time in 1927, 1928. And so with Harlow Brooks's kind of name on the project, though he did pass away after the first year he visited the campus, for 9 summers afterward, they would have these medical conferences. And these medical conferences took on the character of what was then called a chautauqua, which is a large, kind of really a live internet that would last for 9 days, 10 days, 11 days. And they would rent large circus tents. And it was really the progenitor of the Navajo Nation Fair. Some historians think that that chautauqua that they had in Gannat kind of spurred the U.S. government in Window Rock to compete with them. And so they created this thing called the Navajo Nation Fair, which is still going on today. But yes, Salisbury was very much a showman, and he liked large groups coming together that really appealed to his nature. If he'd been more of an introvert, he wouldn't have seen the success that he had. But yeah, as you said, I hate to make it sound like, you know, this is the Salisbury show, because he had so many collaborators who really believed in the project and would correct him often and help steer him in a better way. He was also fortunate in that many of the craftsmen from that area were very familiar with Western ways of cutting stone, with building, and they learned those crafts from the Spanish, you know, what we call today like New Mexicans, who had come over from Pajarito and Albuquerque area laboring for Hubble. So there was an established crafts tradition already there before Salisbury showed up, so it made it so that he didn't have to rely on outside contractors as much.
The mission, the hospital, the nursing school became quite renowned during the 1930s and early 1940s.
Yes, part of it was that energy that was in the Harvey houses, that interest in the Southwest. You have in 1930, you have Oliver Lafarge winning the Pulitzer Prize, you know, for best novel, Laughing Boy. And so there was the zeitgeist at the time was very interested in the region, the artistry of the Navajo rug, the mythos of the Navajo perspective, the dances. And in the middle of all this, you have emerging this school that was geographically placed in such a way that it invited visitors to come and see it. People would, I mean, if you can imagine this, driving out in a desert where everything is, you know, sagebrush and pinon, and you come up a hill, and then below you see what looks like a giant golf course resort. I mean, that's what you would think if you saw Ganado Mission back then, out of nowhere on a dirt road, and you go, what the heck is this place? People who live in Ganado today and who travel to Ganado a lot, I go back to Ganado probably 9-10 times a year. I live over in near Taos right now. And when I'm there, though, it's really a shadow of its greenery, of what it used to be. Even when I was a child growing up there, I moved there in 1989, we still had green lawns. Everything was irrigated because there's such a large aquifer underneath Ganado that was tapped into in 1921.
The miracle well.
The miracle well, they called it. And it really was. It was quite a lucky shot. I mean, or a miraculous shot, however you perceive it. But it really did lend that ethos to that property of, like, we are supposed to be here, obviously, because we found the source of water that no one had found. And what it really was a vein of water that belonged to what we call the Pueblo Colorado Wash, that was running very deep underneath the Canyon de Chelly formation of sandstone. They had to go over 400 feet down, and they just randomly found it. But the wellhead's still there. But what people often remark about with Ganado today is that there aren't really any hotels there. It's really hard. You can't stay the night in Ganado. You have to stay overnight in Window Rock, or you stay overnight in Chinle. And because it's this interesting crossing point, I've had people even ask me, how come there are no hotels here? And that's because Ganado Mission was the hotel. They had cabins open for people to stop in from Route 40 if they made that turn off at Chambers and wanted to drive south for 40 miles. And they could get to Ganado Mission, stay the night, then continue on to Gallup or Window Rock, wherever they needed to go. And also Hubble encouraged that too. He was the hotel there for decades. His casa was the place you came and stayed. And he hosted many artists in that region, E.A. Burbank and Maynard Dixon and several other artists and, you know, philosophers as well there too, writers.
Many of the nurses and the students who graduated from the mission school, from the nursing school, affected a number of people across the Southwest. And, you know, to cite a few people you mentioned, you know, in the Gorman surname, Rudy Gorman was in the mission school, grew up to be a very famous artist, R.C. Gorman. His aunt, graduate of the nursing school, Alta Gorman, was the model for many of his early paintings.
I passed his house this morning in Taos. It's right by the road there. I said, hey, I'm going back to Ganado, R.C. Yeah, R.C. Gorman. Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting stories about him in the book that people remembered and that his former teachers remember and tell. He was a very lively student there, a very iconoclastic kid, a very creative kid. And yes, his aunt, Alta Gorman, inspired many young women to become nurses. All the women did. And what was interesting is there wasn't a lot of what we call, like, institutional incest. They didn't really stay in Ganado very long after they finished their training. A lot of them dispersed out with the military. Some of them worked in government hospitals. But they provided that quality of care, and they did bring with them, even if they weren't, and many of the women who graduated from there were not lifelong Christians. They didn't go on to become devout church organizers, which would explain why the Presbyterian Church isn't a very large presence on the Navajo Res today. But what they did bring with them that many people remember who were former students and colleagues there at that mission was not so much the Protestant religion, but the Protestant work ethic. And they brought that with them. And so they were rather trustworthy there on time, very professional in their manners. And by all accounts, they were able to create very good atmospheres at the hospitals they went to. Yeah.
You know, the people involved with the mission wanted to raise leaders, and they did.
Yeah, they did. They had several graduates go on to occupy positions in the Navajo government, at the institutional level, providing services to the people, but also in the tribal council. You had people like Howard Gorman coming out of the mission. And at times, Howard Gorman was actually rather confrontational with the mission over some of the decisions they made. Overall, he supported the idea of education, and his relatives were educated there. I know at least three people who graduated from there who were really my local leaders when I was living there, growing up there. They were our superintendent, principal, our council delegate at that time. And the leadership was there. The people I interviewed, in fact, the first Native American state senator in the state of Arizona was a graduate of Ganado Mission, Arthur Hubbard. And one thing the two things that they always would say in these interviews was, number one, we were so good at writing and reading English, we couldn't be cheated anymore. So that was a big one. And the other was that we had that work ethic that we learned at the mission, because really the kids ran that place. There was no way they could have survived without the kids working 2 to 4 hours a day at specific jobs at their dairy, at the feedlot where they had cattle, out in the fields where they grew their own food and canned it in the dining hall. And they kept the place very clean. They kept the lawns, gardens, flower gardens. They worked in the mechanical shop inside the powerhouse, or they called it the powerhouse. It'd be what we call a power plant, running the boilers in the garage, keeping all the cars maintained. Every child there had a work assignment that usually lasted about 2 to 4 hours. It'd be 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening, and then they had required study hall where they would sit with a teacher. And so the class sizes by today's standards were very small.
Yeah, it was all about experiential learning, which mm-hmm. it translated to, free or low-income, low-cost labor. The nursing students were absolutely essential in keeping the hospital going.
Yes, once the nursing school ended there in 1950 because the country decided after World War II to rely on the college model to educate nurses, that is that you'd have to go to a college campus and learn practicum there at the campus. Once that happened, that hospital's days were numbered. And everyone at the highest levels of understanding at the mission knew that. But because the women were the ones running everything, taking care of things on a daily basis, often working to the point of near nervous breakdowns, heavily relied upon. And they did make it work, but the people remember how exhausting the work shifts really were. But what are you going to do? You let someone suffer? you step on and do an extra shift, and that's what you do. So they often felt going off and working for the government was like, oh, this is so easy, compared to Ganado Mission. But yeah, it's funny. We have this thing today where, I'm a teacher by trade. I teach high school. And if you tell anybody about experiential learning, they go, oh my gosh, what a great idea. Yes, we need experiential learning. That's what we need. And they were doing it back then. But you get low-cost labor out of it, but what you have to have is your students have to be there all the time. And make no mistake, the people who went to Ganado Mission, they did not live what we'd call a free life in our modern understanding of it. They were on campus most of the time. If they left campus, they had to have a pass, to get that weekend visit with their family. The family could come on and visit with them onto the campus. That was rather easy. But there was some homesickness involved at times. But that was, from their perspective, part of the acculturation process of getting used to this way of living.
Speaking with Jim Christofik, author of Medicine Women, the story of the first Native American nursing school, it's also a history of Ganado, Arizona, and the surrounding area. You did a lot of research for this going back, at least a decade or more. It does read like a novel, but I would also describe it as a dissertation. Where did you find so many of the archival photographs that you use in your book?
Well, I really owe a lot to Ken Douthit, who is a 1950 graduate. He was a graduate with Rudy Gorman, R.C. Gorman, in 1950. And Ken set up a small museum in the what was then called the dining hall, what was called Cafe Sage when I was a student there, when I was a young person growing up there. And I was a Boy Scout. And so we would have our meetings at Cafe Sage, the dining hall. And I'd look at the archival photographs that Ken put on display. He had them from several families who had been at the mission with him in his youth. And so seeing those on display really sparked my curiosity about this place I was growing up in. Like, oh, look at that. That's the same building that's right next to where I live. Hey, who are those people? What's going on? They got horses and buggies, and what is all this? And so I knew those photographs existed. Ken very diligently created these albums that were only available by ordering them through him. He eventually put them on CDs and allowed them to be electronically accessed through the Manal Historical Library in Albuquerque. But I was also able to contact him personally and get copies from him. And so that was one part of it. The archival photographs are from Ken Douthat and the Manal Historical Library of the Southwest. Fate played a role in this book because I decided to go to college in Pennsylvania, 2,000 miles from where I was from. I wanted to know what America was. I wanted to understand my Anglo heritage. That's all in Navajos wear Nikes. So I went out into Pennsylvania, lived in America for 10 years. And when I was there, I found out that all of the records for Ganado Mission had been taken from Ganado Mission the year I moved there by a PhD dissertation candidate named Bruce Lee Taylor at the Union Theological Seminary in Virginia. He found over 100 file boxes of information from Ganado Mission kind of just moldering in the basement under the church. And so he put them in a U-Haul and took them to Philadelphia and gave them to the Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia on Lombard Street. And there they sat. And I found out when I was living there that this information was there through Ganado Mission. I contacted Ganado Presbyterian Church. They said, well, we think they're over there in Philadelphia. So I called them and I said, could I get a look at these files? I think it would be really interesting because I'm hoping to put together a history or something. Let's just see what happens. I don't know. There was no way of knowing what was there. And they said, well, we have to archive it first. And I said, okay, well, how long do you think that'll take? Oh, probably 10 years. And I said, that's just not, no. So I wrote 16 letters to people in the Presbyterian Church leadership, eventually wrote to the headquarters in Lexington, Kentucky, and then they put it in the hands of the executor of the Grand Canyon Presbytery, Ken Moe, to whom I am very grateful that he gave me permission to see those files without them being archived. And so I went through 85 file boxes of information at that archive for 3 summers, no index, mouse turds falling out from between the onion skin and the carbon copies of the papers, all the staples rusted, you know, and made an index. If anyone wants to challenge me, I'll show you my index. It's many, many, many note cards of an index, which I cataloged with the Presbyterian Historical Society as part of an independent study for my master's degree in American Studies through Penn State. And this was pretty much how I spent my 20s, just figuring out, because I want to know, why am I even here? This is part of who I am, this place. How did this place get to be the way it is? Because I was invited out here by the forces of fate or something. You know, my mom came to work here in 1989. I'm at this place, and I could just, I don't know, I just felt the ground talking to me there. I'm very attached to Ganado. I've always come back there. Whereas, you know, some of my friends who moved there from other places, they're not as attached to it. I don't run into them there. I have a lot of friends who still live there or live in the area because they were born there. You know, my brother and sister were born there, so I feel attached. But that was the other part of it, was that why was I living over in Pennsylvania an hour away from these files? You know, oh, they just happened to be there, and I just happened to be there? Okay. So that's what I mean by fate played a role. If I had not lived in close proximity to those files, I don't think the book would probably have been written, or it wouldn't be coming out this year. It would take a lot longer. So that's partly where the information came from, was Presbyterian Historical Society. And I also initiated an oral history project where I had to get IRB approval and everything. And all the paperwork, get all the permissions forms signed. And I went to Ganado in the summer of 2006 and the summer of 2010 and the summer of 2012 with a tape recorder. And I developed a very, I would say, specific set of skills that allow me to sit and listen to someone for a long time and remember most of what they're saying, but also to tape record and make it seem very natural. So I was able to get a lot of stories. I had interviews that sometimes exceeded 3 hours of telling me about their family members' experience at Ganado Mission, some of them former students who had been there maybe for just 3 years. You know, then they went off the res to go into the military, but they remembered what life was like there. So by piecing things together, also looking at letters archived at the Hubble Trading Post Archive, Manal Historical Library of the Southwest, Presbyterian Historical Society, Hubble National Archives, Arizona Historical Society, there were a lot of documents there I used, and Oral History Project that I initiated and ran. And I guess I'm still running. The sad thing is that as far as I know, pretty much everybody except for three people has passed on now who I interviewed, which really saddens me that they didn't get to see the book published. But there are many who are still around, and I've already given most of them a copy, so they at least know it exists. And we'll be doing that more and more here as I finally get copies coming from the press to send to them. So.
And the families, the descendants of all of those associated with Ganado Mission, either as students or other, they're out there.
They're out there. They'll find me, I guess, or they'll find the book, hopefully. I know there's at least two descendants from doctors who work there living in Santa Fe who I ran into, 6 years ago, 7 years ago now. And so I did email one of them the other day that we had established an email contact. But yeah, they're out there. So find the book. It's out there. And I'm really hoping that, that if they can't find a physical copy, they could find it on ebook. And it's very likely that it will be available as an audiobook as well. I was able to speak to the director of UNM Press just yesterday, and we confirmed that. So,
if you look at the legacy of the Ganado Mission, Hubble Trading Post, et cetera, do you still see connections in present day?
I look at Ganado Mission largely as a lost world. A beautiful world and a challenging world, but it's not really reflected in today's society. The vision that was had at that time, I think a lot of it really just comes down to oil. They didn't have a lot of oil back then. If you had gasoline, it's very expensive. People are not as mobile. So what do? You stay where you're at. And Ganado Mission was a community. It was a community in a way that we don't really understand community today. There are bits and pieces in our society that are like that. But it was a place where people grew their own food, cooked the food, slaughtered their own hogs and chickens right there. They ate together. They worked together every day. And they were taught that to the degree to which you can serve other people, that is your value. Anything else is bullcrap. And that's not common today. The interesting thing is I could tell that to my students today. The degree to which you can help people, that is your value. And that would really resonate with a lot of them. And I do tell them that. And I haven't gotten any parent complaints yet. But your monetary wealth that you can accrue, the three things that Dr. Martin Luther King talked about, right? Commercialism, or we'd call materialism, racism, and militarism. You know, those are the three evils, according to King. We don't have to talk about the axis of evil that Bush talked about, like the three real evils. Consumerism or materialism wasn't really around that much back then. At least people were shielded from it because they didn't have these, weird crystal mirror projectors flashing electronic hallucinations in front of their face on the televisions, right? These didn't exist. You barely had radio back then, really. And so the material circumstances surrounding the place were vastly different. And to a degree, you can still have that in Ganado and other isolated places like it. It's very quiet there. You can still hear the cows farting down in the wash, from the top. So it is quiet. And there are some institutions reflected today. I mean, the idea, of course, that, you know, because you're Navajo by birth, therefore you can't do a white person's profession. I mean, that's been dispelled at this point. Anybody who would believe that, this is ludicrous, right? They get laughed out of the building. There's just no way that's tolerated. We pretty much have embraced the idea of competence being a reality, which is great, a reality that overrides any genetics. If you're competent, you're competent, end of story. And it is a meritocracy in that regard. So that's there. The idea that that Navajo people would forsake their traditions and adopt white Anglo-Christianity, reservation's a huge place, right? Or the Navajo Nation, now it's called Diné Nation, right? They passed that resolution, so it's called Diné Nation now. The Diné Nation, it's so big and vastly diverse. I don't know what people are thinking in one place or the other, who am I to say? But I'd say in Ganado, overall, there are some people who do hold to that ethic. I know Navajo people in Ganado who have a Catholic cross up on their wall, and they have their white corn up near their mantle to say their dawn prayers with. And they also have a statue or like a bust of Chi Dodge in the corner too. So there's many reference points of spirituality and how to direct one's life. And then I also know people there who don't have really any spirituality whatsoever, and they're kind of a lost individual. So I don't know what they cling to. But there are also people who follow, you know, the NAC, right? So they do all those things, and they do Native American church. They call Teepee Way. So it's a big mix. So I would say that the philosophy that Salisbury and many of these people were trying to put onto the kids didn't really stick. But that really was a concern of Salisbury's, to be clear, he had that same philosophy that people of his generation were raised with, that the Native Americans going to vanish from the face of the earth, and so are their beliefs. And Salisbury, in his experience, he saw the beliefs going away after World War II. Alcohol was becoming more pervasive. The automobile was changing things. We really still don't know what it does to the human mind to fly through the air at 60 miles an hour in a cage of glass and steel. We don't really know what that does to our mind. I think it changed things. I mean, people would argue, oh, that's not true. I think, you know, the ignition of the first H-bomb changed things. The atomic bomb changed how people perceive their own mortality. So technology does change things. But when all that was changing, he believed that Native beliefs were going to go away. And I know many Navajo people who think that's true, that there is less traditional belief now than in 1930. But Salisbury really worried, what are we going to replace it with? Because it can't be a vacuum. Now, his perspective was to replace it with Protestant Christianity that had worked for him and his family. So obviously, he's putting his own understanding and imposing it on other people's reality. But the Navajo people overall, as far as I know, in that region, have not done that, right? They found other ways. And I know several people from that area who are Mormon, and they couldn't be happier. They love being Mormon. So that was probably something Salisbury didn't foresee.
The book, Medicine Women, the story of the first Native American nursing school, available on Amazon and elsewhere. Do you have a Facebook page or website?
You can find me on Facebook by just typing in Jim Christofik, or you can find me on Facebook by typing in Navajos Wear Nikes. I also have a website, www.jimchristofik.com.
That's K-R-I-S-T-O-F-I-C.
Correct.
Really interesting piece of work you've got here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It feels really weird not to be writing it anymore.